Welcome to another episode of Money for Nothing, the podcast about music and capitalism. I'm Saxon Baird with Sam Becker, as always. Sam, there's some pretty nice news that we woke up to a couple weeks ago, that the United Musicians and Allied Workers got together with Rashid Tlaib and Jamal Bowman and decided to put forth the Living Wage for Musicians Act. I mean, we don't need to go into it, but the news cycle in the last, 6 months to my entire lifetime has pretty much been horrific. And so, I don't know, it was kind of nice waking up and reading about this. This, I guess, cool news. We call it cool news, right? I mean,
Yeah. This is cool news. It's cool. Yeah. It's an end by members of Congress who are proving their worth in many ways.
Yeah. The few among many.
The proud not doing that.
Yeah. So yeah, what's it about? I'll let you explain what it's all about.
Yeah. So this is exciting. And it's actually part of a broader wave of legislation that we're not going to get into today, though, Saxon. We should probably do at some point an episode about like all of these different Canada recently is either, I think passed, but it's trying to pass a bill, France, the EU, all these, Uruguay, all these different.
Go Uruguay.
So yeah, there's an interesting kind of tidal wave, maybe not a tidal wave, a tide of legislation, let's call it.
A growing tide
of legislation. as I think that in the wake, and in the broader context, it makes a certain amount of sense, right? We're in the wake of major creative industry strikes. We're in, the sense that AI is about to start changing things and the tech lash continues. I think there's this long period of time where it felt like there was little or no way that you could roll back the kind of world-creating power of these companies. And strangely enough, it's like, in the U.S. context at least, it's a little bipartisan, that folks on both the left and the right aren't necessarily buying what some of these companies are selling and not buying the reasons that they're giving, which even though the reasons on both left and right for kind of thinking critically about these tech companies are very different, to me that suggests like a broader like ideological shift, right? Like something deep structural is changing that makes certain kinds of critique possible now that wasn't possible earlier. So that's maybe like the 2 million foot view. More specifically, I think that there's been a real, in the wake of the pandemic, there's just a sense that streaming isn't working for folks. And there's been clearly, UMA has been really great about bringing together in like kind of focused advocacy campaigns and really creating a conversation around this. And around the problems with streaming. And so, yeah, and on the flip side, we know that the streaming companies themselves have started to change their rules. Check out our recent episode on that. So if they can change the rules, why can't we?
Exactly.
So, yeah. So this is the kind of the basic structure, like what's going on around it. Now, this has just been proposed. I think that there's 0% chance that this bill will pass for a variety of reasons that we're going to talk about. But I do think it's really interesting because it actually proposes, Saxon, some things that could maybe actually fix stuff.
I really
like this bill. I think it's actually really interesting. And I don't know how you get something like this through Congress, but I do think that this is the product. It's simple and it's the product of some serious thought. And it does a lot of cool things that are worth talking about. Okay, so headline number one. There's some reportage that is claiming it creates a minimum of one penny a stream. And that's not true as far as I can tell.
Oh, did you actually like read the bill?
Yeah, no, I sat down. I sat down. And believe it or not, spent all of 8.5 minutes reading the 13-page bill, of which the final 9 pages are definitions of things in the bill.
Oh, I love it when it does that.
Maybe, look, maybe I missed it. I like searched for scent. After I finished reading the bill, I searched for scent.
Well, did you search for like the number one and then the scent
no,
sign?
No, I just searched for scent. So I got a lot of percents. I got a lot of percents. But in the interest in journalism, I just nexted my way through those bad boys. I didn't just see the first percent and give up. No, I kept going. So I don't think that I'm confused about why various music media outlets that shall not be named are just incorrectly reporting the contents of this bill. Yeah, but that's not what's in here. I actually came to this.
Maybe they just want to emphasize that it's not a fraction of a penny. And it'll at least be one full penny or more.
Well, no, that's what the folks were claiming.
But we don't know if that's true.
I don't know
either.
If that's true. We don't know if that's true. Well, I mean, actually totally unclear if it would produce that. But it's certainly not in the bill that it would. And I actually came to this bill being like, oh, it's going to be the penny thing. And that I don't think makes all that much sense. I mean, it'd be cool, but I don't. And then it wasn't there. And I was like, oh, this is an entirely different bill than the stories I read about them. So, okay, here's the big takeaways. This bill is really interesting because in some ways it's not targeted at the music industry. The one penny a stream proposals, right, were like the companies have to pay out a penny a stream. And then we went in, and the reason we didn't like those bills, or thought, not that we didn't like them, but we thought that they didn't quite actually make dollars and cents sense, is that they require companies like Spotify that are actually like not, they make money by selling stock and by having stock, but aren't like actually making a lot of money because they're in many ways bad businesses and are being constantly, any blood that goes into them is being sucked out by Universal Music, among others. And so a penny a stream, just saying you have to pay out more money might just not work. This is different. So what they are doing is, in this bill, raising the price of every music subscription service by 50%. Taking that 50% and then 50%, which should be not less than $4 and not more than $10, taking that extra cash that is being now taken from consumers and then creating a new monthly bucket that is paid directly to artists on a how many streams do each of you get ratio, which is a really different way to approach dealing with the music industry. A, it's bypassing the labels, which is crazy, right? That's not money that's going through the labels. That's money that the government is now taking, collecting from consumers and then paying out to artists, which is
directly
transformative. I mean, I guess to a certain extent, they're like, this is a little bit more like what happens with the, you know, radio for songwriters or performances with ASCAP, that there's this like music industry, but non record label organization that does this in this semi-governmental way. And they're creating with the Library of Congress, creating their own, good luck with whoever has to organize that data and try to make it work. So it totally bypasses the record industry and creates this like alternate path that, again, with a bucket of money that it does by just being like, all the consumers, you have to pay more now, which like remonetizes music by fiat, which is wild. Wild.
I'll just mention as a little caveat here that if you should, and we'll link to this, but you should all go to the UMAW website, because they're actually looking for signatures, both from musicians and non-musicians. And I will say they do probably, they have a goal, I think, of 25,000 signatures, I believe it looks like, from actual musicians. And they still have quite a bit to go, a little over 12,000. So I suggest you go, and we'll definitely link to it. But I will just say that there is a royalty calculator, which is trying to estimate like how much you would make off of depending on the streams. And as far as we are saying, and this goes into what Sam was saying, that actually the calculator seems to be sort of like a rough estimate, and it's not necessarily accurate to what is in the actual bill. But nonetheless, all of our points pretty much remain the same. Just don't take that calculator it's as
a little,
like, fact.
It's a little confusing. And might be tied to a previous, you know, that previous push for a centrist stream.
Right, yeah, there was a previous push in 2022 by Tlaib as well that was also, trying to get musicians and artists paid better for streaming royalties.
Well, and I think that this is the tricky thing about this bill, and that I think I'm really interested in it, which is that, just to be very clear, the narrative of these record industry, the record industry, the major labels, man, they're stealing our money. they're profiting from the artists is a really effective one in the public imagination. And that the penny a stream campaign, which some of the calculations on the UMA website and some other, some of the media coverage around this is I think still calls on the narrative clarity of that campaign. And it's a really effective one, right? Who doesn't want to support artists against the evil major labels?
Yeah.
This bill, it's very important to say, it takes 10% of non-streaming income from the streaming companies and throws it to artists, which is actually really interesting, and is, given how all of this works, that's kind of a big hit, especially to the potential for non-subscription models, right, which are being run in advertising and therefore aren't streaming royalty, streaming subscription money. But to be very clear, this is not being paid out from the record companies. This is coming out of consumers' pockets, which I think is a good thing. I think that people underpay for music. I think music is too cheap. I think that in the past, and certainly in my memory as a, music buyer, I used to spend more money on new records because I had to purchase them. And so there's a real argument that, in a capitalist economy, money talks and everything else walks, and that the fact that various tech companies have systematically undervalued music and used it as a loss leader, we've talked about this a lot, has been really bad for music as an ecosystem, because it gives it less weight in the world, or less obvious weight. But I do think that there's going to be, it's a tough sell to say your Spotify subscription is now $16 a month from 11. And that's what this bill does. And that $5 is going directly to artists, which, again, I support and want to be very clear. I think that this should happen, but it's a trickier political thing to nail. And you can see already how various industry attacks are going to come at bills like this, especially given the fact that this money is not being distributed through record companies, which all of a sudden breaks a huge structure of dependency that exists between record companies and artists.
Well, it did make me think that maybe that's part of the reason when you were explaining it, why the bill was shaped that way, because maybe, if you're not taking money away from the DSP and you're not taking money away directly from the record label, although one could say if the consumer is paying more, then that's more potential money for the DSP and the record labels to earn. But because the money isn't coming directly out of their coffers, pockets, whatever, then maybe they thought that this would be a way in which you could bring this forth in front of Congress and you're less likely to step on the toes of the major lobbyists for both of these industries. But I don't know.
No, I think that's a good point, because so one thing I think about a lot in this kind of system is what we learned when we did that episode about a couple episodes about Ticketmaster, right? Where one of the things that Ticketmaster gets paid for is being the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Some of the fees, some of the quote unquote bullshit Ticketmaster fees are actually being given to the artists, are given to the venues, are given to all types of folks who need the income or need their palms greased in various ways to make this industry work. And part of Ticketmaster's value proposition is they'll hate us.
Right.
And we're happy to have them hate us. And then you don't have to be hated. And I do think that clearly there's, subscription fees are inching up, but you could imagine this opening a conversation where it's not us, it's the government, and it's a bipartisan bill, and it's for the musicians, and it's not us. And that something like this could give cover. Now, you might also imagine a world like you were saying, and this gets complicated business thing, where if they had a choice, if you're either Spotify or let's say Universal Music, and you had a choice of, do you want in some ways your piece of the pie to be $11 and then this government piece of the pie is $5.50 that you don't really deal with? Or if that's a doable proposition, oh wow, we could have been charging $16 this whole time and maybe paid out more to artists, but like had a bigger pie by 50%.
You're saying if they were charging 16 and then this gets passed and it has to up it up to like 20. And you're like, well, that's almost like a doubling. What, if you pay like $9 now? $9.99, 10?
11. It's 11 now.
11 went from now. $9.99 I don't know. Just like 20, another,
with inflation,
an extra 25%.
With inflation, it's like, yeah, it's like 8 from when they first started.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
But at the same time, like that remonetization might be the way to do it. It's just like stuff happened semi-organically that made music in America worth less within the system that it could be used, partially because the way that the enforcement mechanisms for monetizing music fell apart, like kind of famously, which the enforcement mechanism being you had to buy it and CD in physical form. And so we've talked a lot about like what does it mean to remonetize and how could you remonetize, and we've talked about the idea of like sectoral remonetization, like that these huge, you know, a huge chunk of YouTube's value is based on music, but it doesn't look that way because it's kind of like ancillary. It's like the videos about Napoleon's campaign in Jena has more value because you can also watch Shakira next. Like, and having the entire catalog, having on your website the entire catalog of recorded human music, basically, plus all the other stuff, makes all the other stuff more valuable in a way that can be hard to capture the value of. So we've talked before about the potential for, like, whether you need some sort of sectoral, maybe even governmental structure to, like, move that value around in ways that allow music to keep functioning, that allows you to water that musical ecosystem so that musicians can keep making music or else they'll go away. But once you've killed the music scene because no one can make money doing it, like it's not that easy to get back. Music scenes need to be healthy. Musical and cultural ecosystems need to be healthy. And so part of me is like, yeah, like fiat, this is kind of the imagination behind this where you're like, oh, the government can just do a big thing like this that just, oh, the all music is worth, right? The government can make music worth 50% more this month is real imagination, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, no, I like that. I think that's a really good point, and I think that that's something that maybe we need a little bit more of just generally in the world, that like, hey, you know, the government could just do like big shit that like actually makes a huge difference in people's lives.
Yeah, so I mean there's a couple other little pieces. So in addition to that, like that big sweeping idea and the way, which I'm you know struggling to think through, like the full implications of giving musicians an entirely non-record label structure for payouts, which really cuts to the core of the power of the labels in all kinds of ways. Like, it's like I love it. It's wild. I don't think it's going to pass, but it opens up so many interesting conversations in so many different directions. And one of those is there's a couple other pieces of like little bits and pieces in this bill that, again, reveal that like world reshaping imagination. So one of them is the 10% of all non-subscription money, which is interesting because A, that slush fund is kind of important for all kinds of people in the industry. But B, if you go back to our conversation with Meredith Rose about streaming in the dark, the only way to do that, to get that number, would be to audit. And all of a sudden, all like just the implications, which I'm sure everyone is like, ha, 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 no, you're never getting that number. Because like that number tells you a lot. Like that 10% might be a lot bigger than people think, or might, you know, it's who knows exactly how these things work, or much smaller, right? Like if advertising is, as some people have suggested, like not functional for certain kinds of like music streaming services. But there, and then a couple other places in the bill, there's just kind of you know, and obviously we'll have to like double check the money, which is totally fair, but like also not something the record industry has literally ever been interested in substantively since 1890. If not earlier. Like I've found like newspaper articles of songwriters complaining about crooked books in sheet music publishing. Like it's always been thus. And so yeah, having that kind of government oversight into this industry that's really thrived on opacity would be really exciting. And like, again, the takeaway from that Rose interview, which is that there are fundamental questions about the political economy of music. Like, are musicians making more money now than they did previously? Which like the answer seems like it's no, and certainly a lot of folks think it's no, but also literally we don't have the facts. And so is it a different set of artists making, like, we don't know in this fundamental way. And it's very hard to understand what the implications of any kind of bill or any kind of legislation would have on the musical ecosystem when these basic facts are just so hidden behind so many layers of NDAs and secrecy. And so that's one big implication. Another, and this is my favorite, Saxon, this is by far my favorite part of this bill, which I am nerding out on, clearly, is that in the calculations of streams, it's whatever is lower. Like in terms of, you know, figuring out your percentage of this additional money pot, it's whichever is lower of however many streams you get a month or a million. Which
right, yeah, I love that aspect of it, yeah.
Right, so just like, which means that for this payout bucket, which given how much money people make from streaming services is, I think, is going to be more than they currently make from streaming services. I think that's, certainly that's what the calculator suggests, but I think that that's likely to be more. I don't think that 50% is a big chunk to be paid directly to artists bypassing, you know, keeping the lights on, all kinds of other stuff. Capping that payout at a million streams a month is a totally different way to run a music economy. Like, and I think that so that means that if you have let's take a classic one hit wonder song. Like, just thinking about the ways that this kind of change in the payout structures would start reshaping the music industry. Say, classic song. My personal go-to one-hit wonder is Blue by Eiffel 65, which I imagine, when became a global hit, generated, and it was pre-streaming, but let's say Eiffel 65, Blue happened now, would generate a huge number of streams really quickly and then trail off. And that one-hit wonder, a huge chunk of it would be in stuff that's over a million streams a month, right? If you have something that goes, you know, streaming style platinum for a year and then falls away forever, like, it's really pushing back against those people, like a music economy where those have always made similar amounts of money. This is actually pushing towards, it's better to have a lower, slower simmer of a whole bunch of streams constantly rather than being a one-hit wonder in this really interesting way.
Why do you think it is that, though? Because if you're looking at the language, it says like, you know, it's about qualifying streams. It says the lesser of, and it says A, either the number of streams of the master recording accrued by an artist, or B, 1 million streams. Like, I why do you think that is? Why do you think that that's like the...
Because they don't want all of this to go to Beyonce. They're doing it by percentage, and big folks. This
actually, Imagine Dragons. Let's be real; they're getting more streams.
Yeah, no, it's Imagine. It's Imagine. No, a million streams per song per month. It's per song per month, right?
Yeah, per month. Yeah, yeah, and at a calendar month. Yeah,
per track per month. But that's the thing.
Like a master recording, rather, at a calendar month. Yeah.
So that's the thing. I actually think what's really interesting about that million stream a month is like, is it doesn't. Imagine Dragons is a perfect example of someone it's not going to kill, actually, because right, anyone okay. Who's huge and has a long tail, right? They release a new album and it gets...
No pun intended.
Right? Like, like, what's interesting about this, I think, is the way Imagine Dragons is a perfect example to think through, not just because we've just spent a lot of time thinking and listening to Imagine Dragons, but you could imagine, you'd imagine, right, that the way, if this was passed and it became a primary payout mechanism for the industry, think about how it would match onto a major Imagine Dragons album. The album drops, the two or three hit singles generate way more, for the first couple of months, more than 1 million streams a month. All of that is cut off, right? A song can generate 15 million streams. 1 million streams is not that many streams for a hit song at all. This is like really like mom and pop musicians. Like, yeah, no. Like 1 million is like a moderate hit. So for the major payout of the system, anything that is over a moderate hit, all those extra streams don't count. But now it's a year after, and many of the, you know, then the big hits, I mean, I don't know if they get, they probably even get more than that, but like they'll get 1 million streams forever. Some of these, 1 million streams a month, are close to it for a really long time.
At least 1 million. Yeah.
So like, but anything over 1 million doesn't count.
They'll clock in. Considering this bill is, like, they would clock in, they would clock the 1 million like every single month, basically for a long time. Yeah, years.
Right.
Yeah.
For a really long time. So it actually, in this funny way, like pushes toward this pot of money, pushes it towards folks with longer catalogs, folks that are racking up more, you know, like the best person to do is to have like 15 songs that are always clocking 1 million streams, not have had a career where you had a couple of big hits and then not as many. Unfortunately, at some level, that actually just means that this is Rolling Stone's bait once again. Like the band that is best situated to profit off of this and disproportionately get wins is a classic rock band with a ton of hits that like all get around 1 million streams a month, but doesn't have anything new.
Well, because I would actually push back against the kind of things you're saying, and maybe this is where my math brain comes in, which is not my strong point. But like, if you're like a one hit wonder, and like with like a quick hit, and then it dies off like a month and a half, 2 months later, then potentially like you could have, without this cap, within 2 months, earn whatever royalties are giving you, like for, let's say, 300 million plays in 2.5 months before like it really drops off. But instead, because you're only a one-hit wonder, you're only getting paid out for like 2.5 million streams, and then it's like a much lesser number. So like you never get back like that. You're never going to get back like that 298 million streams, which you could have gotten. So I see it does benefit like legacy artists more. So that is what you're saying. And it actually works against, but you're saying that for like the musical ecosystem, that actually might be like a good thing, because it will try to be like a sense that like you aren't just looking for one hit wonders and make a lot of money, and you're trying to have more sustainable art careers. But doesn't that kind of like, I don't know, how do you like, you can't, you know, that's more of an ephemeral sort of thing anyways. Like nobody has like a, well, you know, the KLF has a strict formula for a one hit wonder, but you know, most of the time we can't really say there's like a formula to it as much as people try to like.
No. I think that's right. So I think that one of the things that, I mean, and it's important to note that in this, the utopian future where this bill is passed, everyone's making more money because this is on top of the existing payout. So that one hit wonder is still making whatever.
This is more like a fairness. It's not like I'm like helping out the one hit wonder or like the random indie rock band that gets on the right playlist into the right movie and suddenly gets like a, you know, 1 month of like 150 million streams or something like that. It's actually like, it's just more just of a fairer model.
Well, so no, here's what I guess what I'm saying.
For a long-term, more sustainable future. Sorry, so go ahead.
This is what I'm saying, right? Clearly any version in which there's 50% more music in the 50% more money in the music ecosystem, and that's being given to artists, they will make more money. So it's possible, even in the capped version of that one-hit wonder, like they'll get some real money. But compared to, you want to be the Baha Men, right? Is who you, at some level, you want to be, in that everyone had to buy the CD,
right,
and you, and the, you know, one-hit wonders in the streaming ecosystem, you can have 200 million streams and it's still not like, it's not mansion money. So, and I don't even know like if, would 2.5 million streams be better? You know, we don't have the calculations for that. That's it. But what, I guess what I'm saying is clearly the music industry is organized around money. And so more profitable pathways, people end up doing that, right? So whenever there's a new structural force that pushes people in one direction or another that makes certain kinds of careers more or less profitable, the rest of the ecosystem evolves around that. So rap songs that are really short, like streaming era rap songs, so you can have a whole bunch of them, or really long albums so that people just throw on Scorpion and listen to, you know, 2.9 hours of Drake
all
or whatever.
38 tracks.
or, you know, right. So as examples of like how these kinds of payout structures end up shaping stuff. And what's interesting about this payout structure is the way, is like trying to think, what I'm interested in is trying to think through who it helps, who it hurts, and how people would try to profit from it.
Exploit.
Right?
Yeah, find
loopholes. And so one of this is, you know, like, you could imagine big stars. This really doesn't work well for the current Beyonce model, where it's rare drops of music. Actually, this is like, if you're a superstar, what you want is as many tracks as possible hitting a million streams a month, because anything over that is kind of wasted revenue. And in fact, it's probably better to have a whole bunch of different ones because it doesn't say how many streams you can have, like tracks you can have. And if you just take the same set of listens and distribute it over more tracks, then you get more money. Similarly, I was saying that it's interesting that it does kind of push towards, and you can imagine band, maybe a million streams is a lot, but you can imagine kind of like long tail, medium successful Americana artists doing really well under this. You know, they occasionally have a Jason Isbell. I'm not saying a big, you know, or country, like mid-tier country folks, right? Where they're like doing a lot of songs that have around a million streams and, you know, careers where it's less, you have to be the young hot thing and then it moves on. Things where it's like, it's album 7 and you're still selling a decent number, you know, you still have a decent number of streams. In some ways, those people would be, I think, at an advantage from this kind of thing. And then you'd imagine a music industry where if this is the model, you could imagine a music industry where that really pushes people towards that model. It's important to note, however, that just because the money's initially paid out to a musician doesn't mean it stays with that musician. And anything can be dealt with in contract negotiations. So you could imagine a thing where, you know, actually you need, and this maybe spins out, but this is like what we know about how the system works. You actually need a sustainable career. If the goal is to have 15 songs that get played a million times a month, you actually need a lot of like long-term A&R label support to do that. And then maybe the music industry starts being like, yeah, we can give you that support in order to get you that point. But like 20%, yeah, 20%, baby, 20% of this money coming in.
But I also think that in thinking through this model, like it also doesn't take away what we've talked about it in a more recent episode, which is that like you can like make a living off like a one-hit wonder essentially, even if it's capping at a million streams and then you're getting this extra percentage, like you're still making a living. It's not like
no, it's true. And you could just have a song that like keeps that, if it's a, I mean, I guess,
or it goes away and it comes back or whatever. Yeah, but like
I guess it depends on the kind of one-hit wonder.
Yeah,
and which sure. Also changes the music industry, right? Like there's a lot of people who like, you know, the classic, trying to think of a good example of, you know, like Ecstasy, right? Where it's like they've got Senses Working Overtime, which is probably their biggest hit. And like maybe, you know, or, you know, there are a million other bands like this where like they had a career. They have got one hit that actually broke through for whatever reason, but they are still able to tour and build on off that. And yeah, no, it would kind of support those. And if it's a good song that, you know, the one hit wonders that people want to listen to all the time, and not the one hit wonders where it's like, no offense to the Baha Men, but like, who let the dogs out, dance floor banger, but it doesn't have, you know, the full staying appeal of some, not I take that back. I love Who Let the Dogs Out. That's an incredible song. I've got nothing bad to say about it. Here I am trying to lie in order to make my point. But you know what? I can't do it. Baha Men Forever.
Yeah, I mean, like, making new generations of toddlers enjoy the genius of pop music, like, still. Like, numerous times I've noticed children hearing that song that are, like, under the age of five and then enjoying it.
It's the woofing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the woofing. You get to woof.
Baha Men and David Byrne, you know, that like, sweet like spot music between... for toddlers becoming adults.
And with that, I think we're going to transition to our second topic.
So like we're gonna slide into to another topic.
Slide into the DMs of the mayor.
Which actually, like, you know, you want to talk about the government doing big things, and
our mayor always doing too much.
And to talk about opacity and opaqueness of certain companies. The United States is gonna get rid of TikTok, boys and girls. 170 million users, nearly half of the country. It's trying to get rid of it. I mean, recently, as you might have been reading, the House passed a bill that would force a sale or a divestment, if I'm understanding correctly, of ByteDance, which is the Chinese company that owns, runs TikTok. And it would give it like something like, I don't know. I read
like
through a lot of
this. 6 months.
It's like six months or something, or like 168 days.
I don't know which of these pieces of legislation is less realistic, to be honest. Like, take our culture with the seriousness it deserves. Come on, folks. 6 months is not good.
Yeah, put forth by obviously a paranoid Republican from, I believe, the state of Minnesota, who will not be running for a re-election, but wants to go out with a bang by supposedly banning TikTok. Mike Gallagher is his name, if you're curious. And he says that the U.S. cannot take the risk of having a dominant news platform in America controlled or owned by a company that is beholden to the Chinese Communist Party. News platform in America. That's a pretty intense.
I mean, especially
intense description of TikTok.
Especially given the fact that Rupert, Mr. Murdoch, is Australian. That's a foreign country. I just want to be clear about that. Australia, no shade to our Australian listeners or Australian friends, but it is not a part of the U.S. as I'm sure you'll agree. And so it's always interesting.
They drive on the other side of the road.
It's like, it's always interesting. And I actually don't know where News Corp is based, like, corporately, but like, we know who it's owned by. And like, it's always interesting, like, which countries does it bother you when the news is owned by, and which countries are you fine with it? So like Australian, just for some strange reason, the Republicans are more okay with and I mean,
yeah, well,
weird.
Well, I mean,
how that
you
is.
Could extend, you could actually expand that, and you could also expand that. I mean, like, let's be real, like, the ironies are endless here, and we're going to try to focus a little bit on like what it means, I guess, for the music industry. But like, you know, the ironies are endless here, because you could also expand that to say, depending on like what social media platform you care about, because simultaneously right now there are laws attempting to be passed in the state of Texas and Florida, surprise, surprise, and a pushback against the censorship of certain posts and quote unquote news agencies on Facebook from offering and amplifying misinformation and disinformation on public health, vaccines, election fraud. So now the Republicans on the side are pushing against that. But if you're Chinese owned and your name is not Mark Zuckerberg, then we need to get rid of you and get you out of the US.
So I actually think that they should sell TikTok to RTE. I think that a version in which it's our Irish cultural overlords, I just think it would look, the amount of banter and taking the shit on the platform would dramatically rise. I think sell TikTok to RTE, and like, you know, it's a Gabby platform, and give it to the you know,
it might bankrupt the Irish government, but
it's happened
because
before,
that's also the problem, right? Yeah. Okay. So what's going on? So like let's jump into it.
So then on top of this, on top of all this, and what really piqued our attention about this initially, was not just as the U.S. Congress thinking about forcing a divestment of TikTok, but our proud mayor is suing TikTok and Instagram.
Proud mayor of New York.
Yeah, sorry, proud mayor of New York. All of our proud mayor. I mean, look,
I don't live in New York anymore.
He's America's mayor, and the world is, you know, America's the shining city on the hill for the entire world, which I believe, by the transitive property, makes Eric Adams the world's mayor. Look, I'm not a logician, but I'm pretty sure that's correct. You didn't vote for him, but him and his belief in power crystals and his inability to fight rats successfully is your problem as well.
And his laptop currently being looked through by federal agents.
And his ties to Turkish businessmen and his... Yeah,
the list. And shady clubs in Brooklyn.
And Queens and the Bronx. Yeah. And... Anyway, is basically suing TikTok and Instagram for basically saying that they've, the city, and this is interesting because it's true, I think, probably, that the city has had to spend hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars on teen mental health, and that they think that TikTok and Instagram are not just bad for teen mental health, that they think the companies know that, and that they're pushing, you know, creating addictive apps that suck teens in, and that the city of New York is having to pay to try to ameliorate this problem, and in kind of a cigarette company-esque model, saying like, if you create an addictive thing that we have to spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to try to fix, like, we should get part of your profits to do that.
And this is kind of echoing, I think, also something we saw in New York a couple of years back with Bloomberg trying to ban large sodas.
Yeah.
How dare he prevent my constitutional right to drink 44 ounces of high fructose corn syrup.
Straight. So I do. So that's kind of the general background. And so I think we thought we would talk about TikTok, and clearly to kind of TikTok generally, because kind of in some ways building off of the first half of the episode, or first part of the episode, thinking about our ability to conceptualize large scale change and the ability to potentially do something about it. Clearly TikTok has become incredibly important to the music industry. This is not a strictly musical conversation, but I mean, honestly, the version where TikTok roars in totally reshapes the music industry and then it's just banned is really funny. And so in the kind of the nihilistic version of everything, it's like, that's the funniest outcome just because like, it just like totally, no one will know what to do. And so part of me is like, what happens if that happens? But I mean, I do think that while much like the previous bill, I think it's very easy to say we're going to make TikTok illegal and much more difficult to do it in like legal ways. So I don't think this is going to happen, but I do think it gives us insight into an increased imagination of possibility and an increased potential to both think about how our society is being shaped and potentially do something about it. And certainly it would fundamentally reshape the music industry in all kinds of ways. So I was just saying, so a little bit away from our traditional stomping grounds, but clearly deeply related.
Yeah, I think just to clarify some of the points that you just said, that yeah, basically, I mean, it'd be really, first of all, like, yeah, it technically wouldn't be completely banned. The legislation that has to now face the Senate, it means that, like, as I mentioned earlier, that ByteDance would somehow within 165 days have to divest from TikTok, which is also one of those things where it's like, how can you even fucking prove that? TikTok also now is estimated to be worth around $50 billion. So like finding, I supposedly, an American, or as you mentioned, perhaps an Australian company that wants to go ahead and and buy up TikTok would be difficult. Not to mention the weird like geopolitical ramifications that this might cause. Not to mention also that Donald Trump in 2020, it should be mentioned, did kind of push forth a similar attempt at banning TikTok, and was essentially that federal courts basically like knocked it down, saying that there wasn't enough evidence that it was a security threat to the United States, and also there was a lot of concerns about the First Amendment violations as well. So that's kind of like a background of like probably like why it would be difficult to happen anyways. But hey, I mean, like, it also should be mentioned that, and I didn't know this as well, but it also should be mentioned that actually something similar did happen in regards to Grindr, which was forced to be sold as well, which was interesting. And I actually did not know that. Did you know?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, it turns out that during the Trump administration, the government forced a Chinese company to sell the dating app Grindr because there was concerns that the app, would out Republicans, exactly. Yeah, let's be real. Would out Republicans, cause
live one way and love another
to their alpha families. No, it could expose sensitive information about Americans to China, which is like the same weird China phobia concern that is around like TikTok. So I mean, it has happened, so it could happen. But I mean, I think that this is probably not only facing an uphill battle in Senate, but also probably pretty unlikely to happen. But as you mentioned, there are a lot of interesting aspects to this attempt. And this idea, at least, that we can at least spend the next like 10-15 minutes thinking on.
Yeah. So, I mean, I wanted to start by, yeah, what you're saying about previous divestments and like crazy stuff has happened, right? Bell got split up. That happened.
Right.
Right. Like big corporate changes can be made by government. I mean, kind of responding to your point about it with $50 billion, and there was some nice reporting from a recent episode of On the Media about this, actually. That pointing out like which companies can afford to pay $50 billion, and they're FANG, right? For the most part.
Yeah.
All of which are in deep competition with and have been unable to answer TikTok's challenge in many ways, right? Facebook is trying with Instagram. YouTube has Shorts, that's Google. I mean, Apple has never really had a social media presence, but has the cash to do it, probably has a huge stockpile of cash for a forced sale, which would also necessarily be like probably for a lower price than it would be otherwise. There are only a couple people who could pick up the check, and clearly having a smaller just US based company makes it less competitive. So it's complicated, but I do think that it's worth maybe thinking about what makes TikTok different than other tech platforms, or what makes TikTok similar, and what makes TikTok similar than other media platforms that have existed, because I think that like taking seriously the worry, which I do think is both at one level geopolitical and another level racist. I think it is possible to both be concerned about the rise of a relatively authoritarian China and not be racist against anything that has to do with China. And the way that this is being discussed, I think it's important to say, is like, it's clearly racially inflected. And like, for anyone who is really engaged with like the long history of like the quote unquote yellow peril, is like, this echoes stuff from 1900. This echoes stuff from earlier. It's like, it's clearly racially inflected in the type of panic.
And I think it's racially inflected in the type of panic because of the fact that like, if they really were so concerned about like the leaking of information or the gathering of information, then like they would look within their own borders at like the way that like information is leaked to and collected and harvested for money or whatever and resold to whoever, private, anybody, between like, you know, Google or Meta, Alphabet, all of these companies. I mean, you know, read Shoshana Zuboff's like, you know,
surveillance capitalism,
you know, as the latest sort of tome to learn about that kind of thing. So yeah, and so that just exposes the sort of irony of this and the racial like component of this, that it's really just this Chinese Asian phobia for sure.
No, but that's a really good point, and I think it kind of that's a much less like abstract way of saying what I was just trying to say, which is that I think that it's interesting to think about what TikTok is and how it functions as a media source and how it maybe differs, the kind of information that it has kind of differs from the kinds of information that other social media platforms have maybe, and the way that it functions. Because I think it's true. And again, this I've heard reporting about this that kind of points out, well, Facebook has your information and sells it too. And it's not like, and like Russia bought Facebook information in rubles in 2016. It's not like a U.S. company having that information somehow makes it Fort Knox, you know? But I do think that there's something interesting because TikTok, Facebook to a certain extent, but Facebook has a less algorithmically inflected cultural vision, I think. Clearly the bubbles and clearly the rage, like the... I think that there's been a lot of investigation and reportage about, like, did Russian attempts actually change the election in 2016? And I think it's really inconclusive and we may never know. It does seem that, like, shaping the Facebook algorithms to prioritize posts, which we know that they did, that prioritize posts that created certain kinds of engagement and specifically like certain levels of time of engagement, shaped the emotional tenor in various ways of that election and of American discourse. So we've seen discourse be changed by social media platforms, but I, in some ways, I do think that that was a blunt universal hammer of a change in compared to what TikTok does really, really well is feed you things that you're interested in. And it does seem, especially we've seen in the music industry where they can quote unquote heat songs that are blowing up. Like it's possible to shape conversations and discourses by, if only given the increased level of machine learning and AI in recent years, where you can have it totally doable now to every video immediately gets a like fairly detailed subject matter description that clusters next to other subject matters. And you could put your hands on the scale for certain kind of subject matters versus other kind of subject matters that like would be relatively not easy to do, but like not just totally doable. It's doable, like full stop. And so I do think that social media platforms where it's giving people tremendous amounts of information, things like TikTok, so I think that quote you read where it's like TikTok as a media platform is a really, because it's more broadcasty, because it's less conversational, because it does function as a conversation shaping system in a different way, which makes me think about the longer history of American media platforms, right? That we don't tend to like to admit this. But clearly, over the 20th century, and there's all kinds of critiques of this, right, from like Guy Debord on, of like that these big media platforms fundamentally shape our reality and that they need to be understood as non-elected, semi-governmental entities that shape reality and that are an integral part of modern consumer capitalism and modern consumer democracy, which are like, you know, go hand in hand and they're part of a functioning system and that, you know, we don't have full control over that exists as another part of the power structure of our nation. And from that perspective, I mean, it is interesting, right? The like Hearst at the turn of the 20th century and other big media firms that clearly exerted massive amounts of power, but were integrated into the American power structure in different ways than a company that's more firmly based overseas. And so thinking through what kind of role does something like TikTok play? What kind of role does it play in an evolving social system in which some of those older power centers have been more disrupted, right? Hollywood was this for a really long time, and clearly Hollywood doesn't have the ability to create normative visions of the world in the same way that it once did. Or certainly like normative American-centric visions of the world in the way it once did, certainly given the fact that the global box office is more important than the domestic box office at this point. And so I do think that there's this like, it seems like this is a conversation in this kind of complicated way about social engineering in a way that I think can make people kind of nervous, perhaps. And to me, it reminds me a lot of like these questions about the kinds of conversations that happened a lot in the early 20th century, where all of a sudden there are these industrial corporations that no one really saw coming at this scale and were clearly like integral to the way America was functioning at a business level, but also at a social level, that they were organizing American society. And there were these conversations about like, holy shit, there are these corporations and they're acting differently and have an ability to shape American society unlike anything we've ever seen before. And the corporations are kind of freaked out by how much power they have, though they like it. The politicians are freaked out by how much power they have. And there's this conversation about like, okay, what do we want our society to look like? And I think that over the course of the 20th century, and certainly in the 21st, we've lost that ability to like have those kinds of conversations. It's, you know, some of this is neoliberalism, the idea that it's all just individuals and will kind of work itself out. But like TikTok is not an individual problem. TikTok is a social collective question. And trying to say like, we're going to have algorithmically designed social media platforms that shape people's lives and how they think and how their reality functions. What do we want them to look like? And yeah. I keep thinking, not to go back to the late 19th, early 20th century again, but there's this moment with like Teddy Roosevelt where he's like, maybe the president gets to give every corporation's charter is going to be reviewed annually by the president. And any corporation that doesn't do what the president wants, like you can break up. Like clearly that didn't come to pass, but like that's where we're at right now. It's like, what are these new forms of social organization? What are they going to, how do we interact with them as a society? And how does anything that we do to them then start to shape what our society is going to look like going forward?
But I mean, don't you think that, I mean, just in regards to like TikTok, like that's not something that actually like is going to, like we're already seeing that. Like regardless of like TikTok exists in it, like in the United States or not, like that sort of social question in which like you're putting forth, like what about that is like specific to TikTok?
I think that TikTok, what we're seeing with TikTok, because I think it can be a political target because of anti-Chinese animus, I think it's opened a space for these kinds of conversations. Because banning Facebook is unimaginable. People pull Facebook in and yell at them. But like, I think that somehow, because of TikTok's incredibly rapid rise, because of its disproportionate popularity among young people, because that it's more explicitly algorithmic in a way that people can get a feel of, Facebook doesn't feel, and Twitter and YouTube, they feel algorithmic, but that not in the same way. TikTok is so clearly has an algorithmic aesthetic that I think that part is more prominent. And even like, you know, 75-year-old senators are like, oh yeah, that's a different thing. And I see how it, so I think it lets it be an object of like consideration and analysis in a different way, maybe. So I think that's why. But I don't think there's anything special about TikTok necessarily, but except that they're having this conversation about it and they're not having this conversation about YouTube as much.
I mean, I think that you're bringing up all these like really interesting points that I would like not push back on or disagree with, but I don't think it's actually opening up a space for that. And I don't think that actually that is the conversation being had. And I think that actually what's happening is that the conversation that is happening is reflective of the society that like these sort of, I guess, just to put a huge umbrella term over it, new technologies and like this sort of new growing AI generated algorithmic ish social media that's like constantly serving us and reinforcing our own biases. I think you're seeing these conversations play out in real life about this kind of thing. This sort of like,
what do you mean?
That like the sort of conversations that are like, that are actually being had around, if you read, you know, around like the banning of TikTok, is the kind of like paranoia, disinformation, not actually having a conversation about it, but actually kind of just like screaming into like the void to sort of like reaffirm your own biases. I think it's almost like a byproduct of the sort of like social media, new technology, whatever, what you want to call it, the society that technology is shaping.
I hear that. That's a really, and it's a really depressing, yeah. It's a classic and Saxon and depressing take. I love it. I'm here for it.
Well, I mean, and like, I think my take is like a little bit reinforced by a really interesting piece that was written by J. Caspian King in the New Yorker recently. I guess it's like some sort of like new series he's doing in the New Yorker, but he does talk about this, you know, kind of building off this idea of like Malcolm McLuhan's like the medium is the message, and kind of like describes like technology as like essentially like an ideology, because it imposes its way of life, a set of relations amongst people and ideas about which there has been no consensus, I'm quoting now, no discussion and no opposition, only compliance. Public consciousness has not yet assimilated to the point of that technology is an ideology. But the form of that political discourse, millions of arguments, is actually what makes it impossible to process and follow what should be an evolving and responsive conversation. And so it's the idea basically being that like this technology and this new sort of way in which we now engage with our ideas of reality or society or have these conversations is in a strange way a byproduct of what's happening in the government.
I hear that, and I think that's a profoundly historically misinformed take. I think that it misses how transformative previous technologies and the forms of social and economic organization that accompanied them have been, and it misses, I think, historical record of, yeah, there will be sometimes there's a time like. There was like arguably 20 years where the railroad companies just ran the United States, right? Yeah. And you could have said the same thing about that. And then people catch up or something happens in government. And some of that, right, was, you know, if you think about the populist movement and the progressive movement, it's politics, which means it's American politics, which means it's always like a mixture of paranoid racism, frankly, and like visions of how society could be changed could be changed.
So this is a kind of part of like maybe this sort of like catching up that like maybe these like, because, well, let me just put forth one idea and then I'll actually respond to my own idea. But like this idea that like the people in the government are like realizing like just how important now like these platforms are, even more so than they did in like 2016. With like whatever the supposed like they were meddling, but you know, influence of like Russian meddling on the media, right. And then on the flip side of it, somehow like control that, but I don't know if it feels, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. It's like there's a sort of realization that these are like powerful platforms, and that's why there's wanting to be this sort of like circle the wagons and make them like amongst a more like conservative, although it is bipartisan, amongst a more conservative sect that like wants to like circle the wagons and somehow grab control of this, or at least make it like American.
I think that's true, but I also think, and this is why, you know, why I think that this moment is interesting and why the kind of legislation is interesting, right? Because in some ways, it's, if you think about how, you know, in the kind of long half century of like more or less neoliberal visions of how to run American life, right? It's been pushed on the individual over and over again, right? That's the kind of solutions. That's who has the responsibility. Yeah. That individual, whether you go to individual tech entrepreneurs, that's the kind of heroes that we have. And even in terms of, you know, there's been really interesting work done on like early Ralph Nader and the vision of like the way to deal with companies is individual personal injury lawsuits and like consumer protection as the primary right. thing. And in some ways that's to a certain extent, no, it's not actually, neither of these lawsuits. And that's what I think is really interesting about them. And that's why I think that the sense of that there's something different happening here is that neither the New York City lawsuit nor this conversation, this relatively paranoid conversation about TikTok, say that with enough fixes, with enough guardrails, we can just let, you know, that the system of the market broke a little bit, and with a few guardrails we can get it back on track. Both of them are saying things have changed fundamentally, mm-hmm. and we need to make a choice to actively structure our society. I think that this is that you can't just be left up to chance, that And we have to make certain kinds of choices. We either need to let TikTok in or need to not. We need to think about the public health and organize around it or not. But that there's no normal. And I think that's the thing I find really interesting, that both of these maybe are a recognition that there is no normal, and that in order to make a functional society, we need to make choices about what that society are going to look like. And that, I think, is a really... that's a potentially productive way to think about these technologies that feels very different from the discourse of the last decade plus.
I mean, I hear what you're saying. I don't disagree with it. I just don't think that, like, there's something fundamentally, like, I see that being directed at TikTok because of this racism, Chinophobia, yeah, communist phobia, whatever. But I don't see that conversation being directed so much at Meta.
I mean, New York is suing Instagram.
No, but I mean, I do see it, like, a little bit of the concern. I mean, like, you know, Zuckerberg has to go in front of, like, you know, Congress and all this stuff and answer questions. But I don't know, they're not trying to ban it because it probably helps the economy, or they're not trying to, like, break it up or whatever. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Okay, well, I think there's a lot of open-ended questions and, like, here, and, like, I want to go ahead and just, like, we'll just kind of, like, leave them there. But I do want to ask a few questions to wrap up, to bring it back to music, like, considering that right now the music of UMG is, like, not on TikTok,
yeah,
how do you feel like the majors feel about this, and, like, how do you think maybe this affects the musical ecosystem? I mean, in the rare case that it actually does get bought out by somebody else, but I see you, yeah, raise your eyebrows in interest, but I just want to act like, I just think the music industry gets involved and makes their own TikTok. Or something like that. I don't know. Do they? Or that's one option I thought of, you know, but I don't know. What's your take?
I mean, I think it's a question about... that's a really interesting question. And I don't know. I think that... I love that question. I love that question. Thank you for that question, Saxon. What a good question. Okay, so I think that... I mean, clearly they're starting to play hardball. So, like, right now, UMG and TikTok are not friends. And so a global company that, like, doesn't need US copyrights in the same way is a tougher negotiator, maybe. Previously, I would have said I would have said that given fewer business relations, fewer political relations, cultural capital and nuanced cultural understanding matter. And so I do think that it's been interesting that companies tend to, certain kinds of cultural companies, given relative levels of technological equivalence, seems like local companies tend to win out a lot of times in ways that have surprised me, you know, with local streaming services versus Spotify. And I assume that's because the people in local streaming services, A, have the ability to make deals like telecoms that help, and B, just understand the music market better in a way that makes it a little bit better in a very tight run race. And so I would have said that TikTok should probably play nice with the labels because they really understand US music. That clearly hasn't happened. So maybe they would love a weaker, more
domestic, yeah,
localized one that they can just domestic, that they can just sort of own. But the thing is, it won't be spun off totally. It will be owned by someone, probably. And then it really depends on who and what happens. Because I do think that the labels have probably done... having some competition between these various services is probably good for the labels, right? When Apple was the only market in town, game in town, it wasn't good for the labels at all. You know, if it was Google that bought it, there's no way they're letting Google buy TikTok. But, like, if Google bought it, given how well YouTube works with the labels now, that might be good. But again, that's a lot of power.
I think, though, you could generally say, though, that, like, Lucian Grange would like to see a domestic, racism or not, would probably like to see something that was, like, more within the borders and the legislation and the laws of, like, the United States, like, or, like, something similar to, like, to have to negotiate with.
Probably. And look, clearly the music industry likes negotiating with smaller companies. They'd rather have it be Spotify sized than Google sized.
And then as far as, like, the music, as far as the musical ecosystem, I mean, like, I mean, I don't, they may take, like, an initial hit, but it just feels like these sort of there's so many musical touch points that are like starting to pop up, and there's so many like new ways in which like these sort of fleeting one hit wonder stars that have come out of that, which is already starting to die down now, like the money that the UMG is willing to, and company is like willing to like put into these kind of stars, is already like they're starting to tighten the purse strings. So like, I mean, I think the effect would probably, like whatever is the loss would just get transferred over to some other platform.
Yeah. I think that's probably true. That's who knows. We'll see.
I don't know who
we'll
has
see.
The money, but yeah, we'll see. We'll see. First it needs to pass the Senate, and then we'll come back with another episode. Okay, so we went long this time, but lots to talk about, lots to think about, and as always, we'll be paying attention. Music by Bird Language.
Tune in next time for a track by track analysis of the Imagine Dragons catalog.
Absolutely not. Please subscribe to our newsletter, Money for Nothing. That's the number 4.substack.com. We are a lot more active now on the newsletter again. Please rate and review us. We'd like to see more 5-star reviews, please. And Music by Bird Language, and we'll catch you shortly. Thanks for listening. Bye.